wanted to have more members for us to be able to commence at our meeting. My name is Matulare Coleman, the chairperson of this committee. I just want to introduce other members. We have the whip of the committee, Mr. Ntuli. That's a huge gentleman there. And then we have next to him, Ma'am Zodisi, who's also a member. And Mr. Gwabaza, who's also a member of the committee. We are waiting for other members. They've indicated that they will be joining us late. We have a challenge of members belonging to more than one committee. From the onset, express our appreciation for making yourself available. Especially, I'm told we have Money Mentor. That's the one company. We have another company called Battle Bay Trading. They're not here as yet. And then we have Njongolanga Management Services. And then we have South African Constitutional Property Rights Foundation. Thank you. You're mostly welcome. The reason why we're having this public hearing is just to acquaint ourselves as members of this Committee on Economic Development, on issues affecting our small and medium enterprises in relation to access to finance. This has been a problem, and it has been affecting the participation, especially from the previously disadvantaged. Not previously, because most of them are still advantaged. And we feel that something needs to be done, and perhaps you as role players, you might assist in sort of giving wisdom in as to how can we deal with this particular challenge. That's why we welcome this kind of presentation, so that we can also, as a committee, in return, contribute towards the policy making if a need arises. We are working closely with the. We have three development finance institutions belonging to this committee or reporting to this committee, and we feel we need to really give an input into the things that they are doing. We are not going to be able to do so if we don't have an insight into what exactly is hampering progress and development of our small and medium enterprises. So that's why we can't really stop appreciating your availability or your availing yourself to this particular meeting. I'm told the people who are ready, other copies are still being processed. While we're waiting for others, we will start with Money Mentor Finance. And I'm told also that they are represented by Mr. Christo Clifford and Mr. Yordan. You're welcome, sir. We were expecting our DFIs to be here, and so far we have Kula, Mr. Gardner, who's the Western Cape Regional Manager, and Samaf, we have Mr. Naidu. Mr. Naidu is the acting CEO. Most of you might be knowing him from the DTI. He's now seconded to Samaf to assist there as the acting CEO. You are welcomed, and we appreciate the fact that you availed yourself to be here with us today. Thank you. May we then hand over to Money Mentor Finance to give us the presentation. I took it for granted that you've been communicating with Mr. Gwaza here. He is our secretary, the secretary of the committee, and he will be on a continuous basis communicating with you if a need arises for further clarity outside what we'll be engaging on today. Manimitis, I don't know who's leading. Is this Mr. Yotam? Thank you very much. Over to you. Thank you. Your mic, press the speaker there. All right.
Thank you.
You look familiar. Are you related to one of us?
Yes.
Oh, from South Africa. Oh, okay, yes. Okay.
Thank
Very
you.
Very important. You're welcome, sir.
Yes, Madam Chair, money mental finance is the result of a lot of frustrations and a lot of problems that was encountered or that is still being encountered in the SMME and SME markets. The access to finance, we know, hampers and curtails service delivery in the country. And that's why money mental was born, to address that need. Government, through the procurement process, allows small business to participate, but before they can participate, they're dead in the water. And that is the reason why Money Mentor is the absolute solution to ensure service delivery, to ensure quality of service, and also ensure completion of projects within budget and within time frames. I have no doubt in my mind it is the solution, what is being experienced as a major problem in the country at the moment. Money Mentor Finance is a system that has been developed and it is working well in many parts of the country. The latest problems that has also called us is the Northwest, Free State, the Eastern Cape, and there is a footprint of Money Mentor in KwaZulu-Natal. So it is moving all over the country. And it is my pleasure to allow Mr. Clifford to do the presentation on the Money Mentor system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Yordan, Honorable Chair and Members. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I think before I commence, just to mention that this is just an older slideshow still of Money Mentor Finance. If you allow me, this is really how it's being presented, this presentation to the contractors, so because we are working with the people on the ground. So this is the level of the presentation. Right, like Mr. Jordan has indicated, we consider Money Mentor Finance being the contractor's solution. The background of the company Money Mentor Finance goes way back to 2002 when SMME were awarded contracts and these people didn't have access to finance, materials, plant and equipment, even a bit further than that, delivering guarantees to government. So just to say that it's a well-established system, it was one of the first private companies to assist the SMMEs in this market thing. The system has grown into a total solution and has evolved into where we are today, offering services that you'll see further on the slide. Problems experiencing by the contractors directly, and please, we're not accusing anybody, relates to the NCR and FICA, where we've got certain contractors that aren't creditworthy. So we had to develop a system that works around those restrictions. Funding that the contractors experience, guarantees the government for new contracts awarded, materials, hire of plant and machinery, as well as mentorship and skills. The solution that Money Mentor then developed is by supplying these SMME contractors with materials. MMF also delivers performance guarantees on behalf of accredited SMMEs. MMF will guarantee payments to further creditors, such as your plant hire companies, etc., etc., by merely getting a third guarantee in place. Finance amounts considered, and I think this is very important for us to mention. The system accommodates for small people from your 10,000 rand awarded contracts up to 100 million rand contracts, and we're even beyond that now with the assistance to one of the South African banks. The condition that MMF gives to these contractors, they must be awarded a government contract, such as your Department of Public Works, Education or Health. So it's got to be an awarded contract. How people can apply, they can visit any of our stores or they can call, there's an Mpangeni number. Like I said, there's now a toll-free number in Pretoria as well, which is just on the new slide, which we'll make available. The process works as follows. The contractor completes an application form and is faxed back to the office together with an ID, proof of residence, and tax clearance. Upon the receipt of that, we also check references that's listed on the particular application form, a letter of appointment from government, bill of quantities, and what MMF then does, it checks the rates and brings down the bill of materials to a single item list, and make sure that the contractor are making a profit. This is to protect the contractor, because we do experience that a lot of these contractors actually quote it wrong when submitting their tenders. MMF takes that as a first base, ensuring sustainability as well as the deliverability of these contracts, because nobody wants to put money out in the market if it can't be recovered. We're putting government at risk, as well as the contractors and everybody that's involved in the construction industry. Once it's established that the contractor is making a profit, he will have to sign then a joint venture material supply agreement, and a joint venture bank account is opened, or we went beyond that now, where we've actually bought a bank BIN, and either a net bank or standard bank account is open in the name of the contractor. So no more joint bank accounts. We prefer to use now this particular net bank or standard bank account in the name of the contractor. The contractor would also then be required to pay a performance guarantee policy that includes life policy, which amounts to 4.5% of the total material credit. And this needs some explaining. If a contract, for example, amounts to 1 million rand, the contract will be spread over a particular term. Say, let's make it easy, over 10 months, means that there will be 100,000 rands at risk. So to ensure this contract for life, performance, death, disability, and all the necessary insurance actually costs less than 4.5% of that 100%, and the contractor has got access then to all the materials for his contract. So it's a fraction of the contract value, so to speak. Right, how the system works. MMF uses preferred suppliers. Preferred suppliers include your Cashbuild, Builders Market, Mathmart. These are all accredited suppliers with MoneyMeter Finance. The reason why we do a vetting process on the suppliers is that should we experience any problems with claims, in other words, defective materials, that it can be swapped and that we're not at risk that a particular supplier won't be able to supply replacement goods. The bill of material from the contractor is then loaded on the MoneyMeter Finance file server. The bill of materials is brought down into a complete itemized list. In other words, so many bricks, so many bags of cement, so many roof sheeting, door frames, window frames, etc. It's brought down to a single item list. These lists obviously have got stock codes from our various suppliers. The contractor is then issued with a mag strip, a debit card that he can use to buy only these materials from the accredited suppliers and within the correct time frame, because we couple the building program to the stock. So a person can't buy roof sheeting if he's busy with the foundation. So that's how we mentor these contractors to buy the right material within the right time frame. MMF settles the outlet for cash and gets a settlement discount that becomes the income to MMF. It does not cost the contractor any money. Now, this is a very important point. There's no interest charges to the contractors whatsoever. By merely doing a factoring of that, saying there's a cash discount, if somebody buys the material cash, that became the income of MMF. So there's no additional charges to the contractor. His material, he pays the price that he's quoted. I've got to be very clear on that. So it's a, for the better word, in the financial terms, it's the best possible model of what's called reverse factoring. The bill of quantities gets updated with each purchase and thus ensuring no overspending. As the card is swiped, it's a live system, 24/7, the bill of material is adjusted with the quantities that were delivered. The contractor, yes, pays a 2.5% on the total contract value for the usage, call it the mentoring program of MMF, not for the material. Like I've mentioned in the material, it doesn't cost him any cent. But the usage of the system, he has to pay 2.5%. Now, for that 2.5%, he gets financial reports, he gets a bank account, he gets the access to all the financial instrument guarantees that is needed. So we consider this as to be an absolute, if I may use the word, bargain for the contractors, because they otherwise don't have access to any of these facilities or services. Amounts purchased are blocked on the JV account or stroke the NetBank or Standard Bank bank accounts. Once payment is received from government into this particular bank, the MMF gets their money and the contractor then basically gets paid out his money, or he can leave it in the account because the bank account is opened in the name of the contractor. So it becomes an operational account for him. We've even gone one step further where we had the request of certain contractors who actually want to pay their employees out of the, and we've been able to assist them by opening bank accounts to pay the employees as well. Right, the profit remains in the bank account for the contractor to use as he deems fit. So, or it can be transferred to a normal bank account if preferred. There's just an example of some of the sites. This was a border site in KwaZulu-Natal that was a 58 million rand project that was successfully delivered. We've done various projects of that. Sorry, I see that there's some of the, there was still some documentation I see in this slide that appears not to be yet. But anyway, I can talk through that. The procedures, what MMF does, after the successful application of the contractor, we go through a 45-step test to approve the contractors. We've written for the best words our own SMME credit criteria.
Madam Deputy Minister, you are welcome. This is the Committee on Economic Development, the public hearing on SME development or access to financing. You're mostly welcomed. Mr. Mare, we're told you'll be arriving late. You're also welcome. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. I think the criteria that we wrote for the SMMEs, which became our guideline, has subsequently become the guidelines for Standard Bank through various of the insurance products. It's also became now the system of mechanism of control for the pension support loans. So those are the things that we're very proud to bring to the party. successes range from numerous contractors that's been completed, contracts successfully delivered, and actually ensuring the service delivery to government and protecting everybody down the line. I think, with the permission of the Honourable Chair, because I see that there's some of the slides that in this presentation that's not yet, to give you a demonstration of what we actually do. We have got our own point of sale devices. A point of sale device is this device that you use when you go out to the restaurants and you swipe that for payment. These devices are all with our suppliers, and that's key to part of our technology and intellectual property. This is how we can control the spend of the contractor, because there's no other system in the world that does that, where we're actually selling line items over a point of sale device. Now, that's been key to the success of MMF. And like I've mentioned, this compliancy, because we are King C compliant, and we also enjoy a facility from the banks with a triple B bond, that's a banker's blanket bond, which we had to, that was, and we're very proud of obtaining that, shows that the level of trust and compliance that's gone into the system. So I think all in a nutshell, we have been able to assist the contractors. With the permission, I would really think after the questions, if I can just show the last part of the slide, is allowed with the Honourable Chair, and that will be the conclusion then, just to demonstrate the on system-wise and the updates and the reports that we give through that. But I think on the slide, it would actually demonstrate that much better, ma'am. Perfect. Thank you very much, ma'am.
Yes, that's why I'm saying I'm very confident that this is a solution, because it allows the contractor that's even blacklisted or has negative things next to his name to allow him to participate in the economic growth of the country and also of his or her own business. It allows them also to enjoy the economic downstream and economic landscape that we want to transform in the country. This is absolutely the solution to the small contractors or the SMME market and SME market across the country. Because government allows the contractor through tendering, as I said, huge contracts, but they fail at the first hurdle. So the opportunity from government, despite the good processes and procurement policies, the contractor is not supported to take that first step successfully. And through the MMF system, the contractor or contractors is allowed to participate in the economic mainstream. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shogan, and for the presentation. It is quite clear. I hope members, I don't know whether members have any questions to ask. This is just to clarify themselves on the content of the presentation. Mr. Mare, Mr. Ndule.
Thank you, Chair, very
the
much.
The department is also welcomed for economic development. OECD, Mr. Zikode, welcome. Mr. Mare?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for accepting my apologies for arriving late. I haven't followed the whole presentation, but just from where I followed, I just want to ask with regards to the process. I always say that any mentoring actions or where small business can be assisted to acquire the knowledge and skills and expertise, that in my mind is real empowerment. But obviously one must do a cost-benefit analysis to see at what cost. Now, the following is just for my clarity, to just understand, you know, the process and the working of this MMF better. You mentioned that they will be required to pay a performance policy that is 4.5% of the total material credit. Now, that's the value, I presume the 4.5% is the value of the policy, or is that the premium? Can you just clarify in terms of the premium, the real cost of taking out that policy? And then also, if you can explain something more about that policy, what is the objective of that policy? Is obviously, I presume, is if they are in breach, then the policy kicks in. I presume so, but you can just clarify that. Then in terms of how does MMF work, in terms of your preferred suppliers, is it preferred suppliers or is it the only suppliers? In other words, you know, the builders, warehouse and people like that are the mega organizations, but there are many, many, many other reputable suppliers. So what about them? And then also, will the contractor get the invoiced prices, or is there any other loyalty payment from the preferred suppliers? Is there any kickback? And so what is the cost, direct or indirect, for these small contractors for making use or being part of MMF? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks for the presentation. So, I want to check the relationship or working relationship with the NHBRC. If you are any relationship with them, and then number two, whether you've got funders, who are your funders, and or how do you make your profit? How do you survive?
Thanks, Mr. Gentleman, for this.
Thank you, Chair. On the slide that talks about the process, the last part, one bullet, that talks about the joint bank account, together with the last part, one bullet, on the following slide, just below that one. That you have this joint bank account, and here you say once payment is received from government in this account, the contractor authorized payment to MMF. How does one get convinced that you have no role, I mean, in authorizing this money, or you have no control over it, only the contractor has control, because it's a joint account?
Thanks, Ma'am Sotetsi. Madam Minister?
No, thank you, Chairperson. As I was coming in, I did hear something from the gentleman who was presenting that when they give people, I'm not sure whether the assistance or whatever loans, they check, even if you've been blacklisted, you still then get some assistance. What I want to know is then how do they follow what led to you being blacklisted? Whether is that not going to be the same practice with the assistance? Because I think people get to blacklisted by different cases, issues, and they're not the same. So how then do they follow that and make sure that it cannot happen with their assistance? Because some people are just negligent, I mean, in terms of just paying back and all those. Some, a few people, maybe an account, you owe 20 rand and you are taken to the credit bureau, but some surely have got a problem in terms of being indebted. And in that, it is not also part of the problem then that the small business has. It is, what to me, that's not only money. Money is fine, but you need also to have other aspects then that are becoming like a building block in terms of being successful in small business.
Thanks, Madam Minister. Mr. Wagosa.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. My apology also for arriving late. I had to attend to my daughter who is unwell in hospital. On page 3, the top slide, you are saying that you assist MMEs who are contracted to these three departments. Why necessarily only these three departments and not the rest of the state departments? Is it possibly because you have you yourselves are contracted to them, you're still negotiating further with the other department, or is there any other specific reason?
Thanks, Professor. Can you answer those questions, and then we will, from the desk, get other questions after. Over to Mr. Chota and Mr. Clifford.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Indeed, as to regard to the first question, the 4.5% is only on the total value of the exposure of MMF. In other words, should MMF make available, for example, 100,000 rand to the contractor, the 4.5% pertains to 4.5% of the 100,000 rand. That includes contractors or risk for the contractors. We've negotiated, for example, a particular policy with Standard Bank, where we enjoy up to 2 million rands with materials on site. Normal policies only caters in the region of 150 to 200,000 rands. So included in this 4.5%, because that is the actual cost of, in other words, if it's 100,000, 4,500 rand is required. That now includes contractors all risk, life insurance, then also a performance, inbound performance guarantee. So that guarantee can be rolled out should it be required by government for the contractor to deliver a 10% performance bond to government. So that's why we feel it's extremely low, and we've actually negotiated excellent prices, and we've got the support from one of the major banks in South Africa, which we've also would like to acknowledge in their strive to empower SMMEs and SMEs. So the 4.5% on 100,000, if that's our exposure, because with 100,000 we can safely guarantee 1 million rands contract value in total, because our total exposure is contained basically to a 30-day or 45-day cycle. Right, on the second question, as far as the suppliers are concerned, I'm actually glad that this question was raised. We've got preferred suppliers. They are not limited to the three or the four big ones. We're making use of other SMME suppliers that forms part of the CIDP, not the CIDB, but the CIDP, and we're also supporting that. Our system accommodates for the SMME suppliers downstream to also supply materials to SMMEs, because the problem that we've experienced with the smaller scale suppliers of goods to the contractors is that they've got the same problem as the contractors, and that is they don't have access to cash. So we've been able to bridge that gap in the market as well, and our system caters for that. So I've mentioned the big names, but we do strongly support the development of SMME suppliers that's in line with the CIDP. Regarding the invoices, also the price.
Just a second, Mr. Clifford, not everybody was familiar with this construction sector term. Can you just indicate to us what CIDP?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Yes, the CIDP stands for the Construction Industry Development Program. And the drive is to empower, like we're empowering SMMEs and SMEs to have smaller scale supplies of materials and goods to our SMME markets. And if I may say so, the so-called fat cats, those are the well-established businesses that are gaining from SMME markets, needs to be we feel strong that part of their social responsibility investments should empower the SMME suppliers actually on that. So to make material available to that. Now the CIDP supports that initiative to empower more small scale suppliers out in the market. These will be suppliers typically of bricks, etc., etc. And these people also need to be mentored as far as quality control is concerned. that was why we say that's part of the mentoring skills of MMF, to make sure that the grade of materials delivered are in line with the requirements from government. Right. As far as invoicing is concerned, sorry, may I just ask, are there any more questions about the CITP or any of the other governing bodies there?
Yeah, continue the rest of the question.
Thank you, John, Honourable Chair. Right. Invoices, the price, how we go about the system, the contractor would go and obtain a quote from the supplier. This quote from the supplier is then presented to us as MMF. So we leave it to the contractor. It's his free choice and will to obtain a quote from any one of the suppliers. We don't direct him by saying that you can only use company X or company Y. What we do say to them, you've got a choice between various, or if you've got your own suppliers, bring us a quote from a supplier. These suppliers, if they are not on our database, we register them on our database, and obviously going through a process by just making sure that there is a control mechanism to monitor the quality of goods supplied to the market. The price that the contractor then gets is the price that he pays, same price with MMF. MMF negotiates for a discount with the supplier. And the drive behind that, the discount, is because MMF, what MMF does is to pay this material on behalf of the contractor and actually take ownership of goods in MMF and then sells it on to the contractor. So the supplier is not at risk. So MMF takes over the risk of delivering the project then. So the price that the contractor sees as far as the invoicing part, cost to the contractor, is the price that he was quoted directly from the supplier. There's no other pricing escalated in that particular price. Right. On the second question, the relationship absolutely with NHBRC, as well as the CIDB, we do check the references from the NHBRC and CIDB. So we are making use of these institutions as a reference, because we appreciate that if the contractor belongs to any one of these organizations, and we strongly support that, to have that, and they are doing great work. There was just a question also regarding the profit of the contractor. The profit of the contractor remains the profit of the contractor. He was quoted a price from a supplier, and we're just making sure that he gets the materials on site and that he can focus on delivering the contract that he tendered for within the scope of the contract. Third question was regarding the joint bank account. I, however, did mention that we've subsequent to this bought a bank bin. The bank bin is now, we actually phased that out now. I think we've just got one more a joint bank account, but we phased all our new applications. The contractor opens a net bank or a standard bank account in his own name. So we can consider, just for the record, that the JVs, I think I'm under correction, but there's not much. There's maximum one, possibly two joint bank accounts. How we operated just in the past, just for record, is that the contractor would approve the payments to MMF. He wasn't forced to do anything. It was just he would have to approve that. But we did find the joint bank accounts not to be effective, hence that's why we bought the banking bin, because the contract was awarded in the name of the contractor. So the bank account needs to be in the name of the contractor that the contract was awarded into. So that we've sorted and we've addressed that out. So there's a net bank or a standard bank account in the name of the contractor, which is 100% under the control of the contractor. There's no interference from MMF when it gets to these accounts. Question number four, the question the Honourable Deputy Minister had was the assistance that we give to these contractors. MMF acknowledges that people do experience sometimes governments pay late. Our contractors are put on the blacklist for not paying niggly little amounts, whether it be cell phones, clothing accounts, and when these people then try and obtain funds or credit in the open market, it's been impossible for them. MMF, however, what we do, we look at the capability of the contractor to deliver his or her contract. Also, we go work on the references from the NHBRC, as well as from the department in previous work allocated and successfully completed. So, hence, we look at capability. Coupled to that is profitability and affordability of the contractor. That's very important. We do an assessment to make sure that every contract that MMF takes on, that A, the contractor is making a profit, and B, that he can afford, for example, that 4.5% to refer to for the insurance premium, which is anyway a prerequisite by government, because all contracts awarded should have a contractor's or risk. It's quite alarming to see how many of our contractors are proceeding with contracts without any contractor's or risk in place. So we're making sure that we're actually protecting the contractors with this initiative. So we don't criticize or give see down on any of the contractors that are blacklisted. Any person can apply with MMF because we fall outside the scope of, we're not a financial credit supplier, because MMF actually buys the material and take over the risk in the company. So that's why we deliver goods only. It's not as we're delivering finances out to the contractor. We're just making sure that there is delivery. Right. The fifth question, all departments, definitely. The presentation, like I've mentioned, is just an older version, and it is incomplete. I see it runs only to slide number 9 here. There's actually a whole host more that shows the pictures of the system in operation, how the point-of-sale device works, how we actually sell line items over the point-of-sale device, and what data and information pertaining to the contract gets updated with the usage of this card. So we do assist all the contractors with any government contract. So it's not when we started off, we looked at the Department of Public Works because we enjoyed a strong support from the department, especially in KwaZulu-Natal. And as the company grew and evolved into where it is today, all the other government departments came on. So we've got an appetite for any government-awarded contract, any department. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Clifford. We're hoping that we're going to be getting the missing slides, because they seem to be very important, because that's the crux of everything for us. We need to know how best your system is or will be can contribute towards making finance accessible to all. I just have a few questions also. One of my responsibilities is to manage time, and I can see that your time allocated is actually expired so far. You're charging contractors 2.5% for the use of your system. So if you give 100,000, you charge them 2.5% of that 100,000, if they request 100,000 loan from yourself. That's what I want to understand. And why only government departments? If anyone comes outside government with a contract that's not government-related, do you also assist? The debit card, Max Trip with and the preferred supplier, you know, relationship that you have with those suppliers. Don't you think that, and you buying on behalf of the contractors, are they losing out on the, for instance, the point system benefits that normally accrue to contractors? Because in this case, it's your preferred suppliers, and therefore you seem to be accruing more points and savings and so forth, and the record for an individual contractor, how does it get negatively impacted upon? What other benefits are there, for instance, for contractors either than the actual financing? Of course, you may say the relationship, you know, and access to other suppliers and role players within the industry. But I mean, in terms of what the Deputy Minister asked, in terms of individual contractor development, I think that is, if you can just give us those examples. And because we have developed that relationship with the contractor, what would you, for instance, give us a case in a point in case, for instance, where a contractor has even done better after having that or experiencing relationship with you? And how many of these contractors are we talking about? Yeah, those are my questions. I don't know whether members have follow-up questions. I'll give just 2 minutes for that, because we are way outside the time limits for the for MMF. Member Tete?
Thank you, sir. I do understand that the MMF has reconsidered the decision for a joint bank account, but I would like to know what were the reasons that led to the establishment of the joint bank account, and also the actual challenges that you experienced, that led to the reconsideration of that joint account, that it changed, you know, register the account in the name of the contractor. What were the challenges and what led to that establishment? And also, if you can provide the committee with a list of contractors you have assisted.
Thanks, Ma'am Sotese. Over to Mr. Clifford and Mr. Yorita.
I just want to answer some of the questions, and Mr. Clifford will answer the others. I think the point of suppliers, if we take a place like Pofadder, there's no builder's warehouse in Pofadder. Pofadder, Northern Cape. But in the Northern Cape, they do build houses for the community. In that community, there must be a person that's making blocks or bricks, or that is doing something to supply into the market. Now, that is the example where Mr. Clifford highlighted here. It's empowerment of small suppliers where they are, where they also have access to the MMF support system. But they will also be assisted to make sure that if they make blocks or bricks, that the quality is correct. Quality support to the laboratory, to ensure that if it must be 4.5 MPa, it must be 4.5 MPa. But the support is also available for the SMMEs or SMEs suppliers wherever they are. There's no exclusion of the support suppliers where they are. I think that is very critical. The other support, if we look at the items Mr. Clifford has mentioned here, is that we know many of the smaller builders, once they buy things, they throw receipts away. It's a fact. Now, through the system that is used, there is clear documentation of whatever they bought. And those are the reports that is given to them at the end of the contract, where they can now go and claim the VAT back from the receiver. And I think through that process, it also enhances the
contractor to move up in the ratings, the CIDB rating, because you have to produce what have you done successfully. And documentation must support the application. Now, the MMF system allows that assistance to the contractor. I think those are the two issues that I wanted to raise. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Absolutely. The question regarding the 2.5%, the 2.5% that is charged is for the services, exactly what Mr. Jordan has indicated. There's full reporting structure for VAT reconciliations and the filing of the VAT 201 forms. That forms part of this 2.5%. It's not 2.5 on top of the material charges, because it's a 2.5, call it for the better word, management fee. And included in that 2.5 is a mentorship. We do put people on the ground to assist the contractor, like we've done now in Freiburg as well, where the contractor lacked a bit of skill, so and that's part of our training process. That's included in this 2.5%. We ensure service delivery for in that instance. The second question, why government contracts? We saw the need and the niche market in government where people were awarded these contracts. We, just from a company's point of view, consider an order from government to be a pay order as long as you deliver in terms of the contract. So it is actually the contradiction what lots of people believe. We see value in that. Other people don't see value in a government order. We do see the value, as long as we can deliver the contract. And that's what we are confident in delivering these contracts. And that's why, hence, the value that we see there. We are also looking now outside of the government, but that's we're in a process with that, because of various reasons, there's no guarantee actually from private companies. The banks are looking that the bond market is not so good. APSA's figures were down by 37% the last quarter. So we are looking at other markets, and there's a lot of requests, but we're treading very carefully forward with that. We have established a relationship and a well-known system with government. The question regarding the suppliers, the benefit of, I should just be very clear on that, the card is issued to the contractor in the contractor's name. It's not issued in the name of MMF. In other words, the contractor starts building up a relationship with a particular supplier, and the details and records of the contractor is also with the supplier. So part of the mentoring skills, as these contractors go from one level, from CIDB to the next, they will reach the point where they don't need MMF anymore. So that's part of our true empowerment. We have done numerous contracts, and that's one of the other questions. We'll be glad to supply a list of successfully completed contracts that we've done. We're very proud of that, so, and we will definitely gladly supply that. So suppliers build up a relationship with the contractors themselves. MMF was just key in unlocking the value to that. Benefits from the system is quality control. That's one of that. Mentorship. We have even got a website where if a person has got questions how to mix cement, at what level, 42 MPa, etc., they can access it with their mobile phone. Now, this is in line with the CETAs, again, for training our people. So we've gone to that extent because we saw it's much easier for the contractor, because all our contractors have got mobile phones. So they can access a website or web page to find out more about quality control and how to mix and do things with a cell phone rather than get 4,000 or 5,000 contractors in a single venue. So we've got them. The access we made that is available to them very, very easy. The other benefits that we offer in the system really, and this is now on the humanitarian side, is that we feel, and we've seen this in numerous occasions now, where successfully delivered contracts actually motivates the contractors, and they take pride in their work. And I'm sorry to say that us men are getting a bit of a beating there. The women are way ahead of us, because in the contracts that we supported, about 60% of that, the contractors were awarded to women. So, and we did find in our experience that the women really take pride in their work and progress faster than their male counterparts. The other questions of the, just on the banking account, the reasons for the joint venture banking account. MMF, like I've mentioned, grew over the years and kept obviously trend with what was required in the market. A couple of years ago, government did not allow the signing of cessions, particularly in the KwaZulu-Natal area. So with no cessions in place, the only other, call it objective or method of collecting money would have been to put in a joint venture bank account with dual signatories and approval by the contractor. We were faced then where government then protested and actually said, but the contract was awarded to the particular SMME contractor. Hence, the bank account cannot be joint venture bank account contractor ABC. So we listened to government and we've gone through the expense of buying a proper banking bin for our contractors. So we, like I've mentioned, we've actually transformed into exactly what is required by government. The, and then the last one was just the list of contracts which we would gladly supply to the Honourable Chair and the Honourable Members.
Thanks very much. Mr. Clifford, Samurai, I'll only allow you the last one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for further clarity, I've asked a question about the whether you get any kickbacks or any from the suppliers. Then also, can you just indicate again with the profitability of these contractors? Because, you know, in the majority of cases, you would probably see that they would use maximum of the facilities. So it means that it's already between the 2.5% and the 4% is already 7%. Now, I think times are tough, so margins are low. So what are the kind of profitability in terms of growth and net profits of these contractors? And especially in the rural areas, the competition is immense. And I'm just surprised that they can basically afford to, you know, to 7% basically to pay that, and then they must still make their gross on that, and they must obviously build their business and grow the economy and, you know, jobs created and all that kind of thing. So what is that? You know, if you can just respond on that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Marie. Indeed, the profits are low, exactly what Mr. Marie has described. The 2.5% management fee, that's what we charge basically for the usage of the system. The 4.5%, that includes the insurance part, which was a costing anyway to the contractor. So it's not on top. The contractor should have been well aware of that. The fact that MMF also checks the affordability, which includes this insurance payment for the contractors or risk, et cetera, we do calculate that, and we're very transparent with the contractors in demonstrating to them how they've quoted. In our experience, just to get to the profitability part of these contractors, anything we've seen between 6 and 14 to 16% up sometimes on the contractors. But a lot of these contractors that we're also getting applications for completely underquoted. I've got to be very clear on that. So unfortunately, for those individuals, we can't assist them financially, and we refer them rather to go to a proper training facility that's also offered by the Contractors Association for them to assist them with tenders and pricing on that. But as far as the 4.5% is, it was a cost anyway to the contractor. 2.5% indeed, sir, that is a fee that's charged by MMF that includes the mentoring part, the tax part, the delivery of all the documentation, the updates to the various quantity surveyors, implementing agents, etc., etc. So I think key to that, also to the MMF success, is the discounts on the material, like you've also just inquired about. The contractor wasn't entitled. Indeed, MMF enjoys a discount varying between 1.5% and sometimes up to a maximum of 5%. The 1.5% discounts are earned basically on cement, which is a very low profit margin. We have got the understanding with some of our suppliers, and just being transparent about that, is that if we would reach certain benchmarks and volumes, that they would look of increasing the discount margins for us. So it's volume driven, but we need to get there, sir. Thanks very much.
Ma'am, if I must just, it won't take a second. I think what we should not forget is there's no charges on the material. It's 0%. Now, if I'm a contractor and if I want to buy material, I don't have money, where do I go to? To a bank. Charges of the bank, it's prime plus something. Now, prime, it's 9.5-10% plus something that will be added on. Sometimes the contractor has to pay up to 17%. And if one compares the two, virtually there's no comparison. You're talking 0% on material other than what the person has quoted from the supplier. No cost, no kickbacks to MMF. We don't believe in kickbacks. It's illegal to do it. We won't do it. But there is 0% to the contractor. Versus the bank, versus ECDC and all the other organizations, it's prime plus something. Then one has to ask, how profitable will the contractor be at the end of the day? If we put the two scenarios next to one another, you have the MMF scenario and you have the commercial bank scenario or any of the peripatals. There's no comparison. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. I guess we've given you enough opportunity or time to present your case, and thank you for that. I don't know how you close the gap, but surely it's somehow that you also are gaining out of the whole thing. We are really waiting for the other slides so that we can complete the presentation. Thank you very much for that presentation. The next presenters will be from the South African Constitutional Property Rights Foundation, and they are led by Mr. Meekin. Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
Meekin, ma'am. Yeah.
Okay. They don't have electronic presentation, but members do have the hard copy presentation. Do members have? ASA CPRF. Do members have the copies? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's welcome Mr. Peter Meekin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, and thanks for this invitation. The South African Constitutional Property Rights Foundation is a PBO, a public benefit organization, which seeks to make land affordable to everyone in accordance with a demand of the Constitution. I'm chairman of this very small PBO. We're simply three professionals, myself, a valuer, we've got an accountant, and we've got a horticulturist. I'm also a civil engineer and a national and international valuer, and specialize in land taxes. I'm also a small enterprise, and I've never been able to get any money for the business until I bought a house. I wish I'd known about these gentlemen over here, because it would have made my life a whole lot easier. But I've never been able to, unless in my lifetime anyway, I don't know what it's like now, unless you had some asset to back up your land, you never got one. So my stance here, Madam Chair, what I want to try and persuade you today is that because it's so difficult to get a finance like this, then we must start looking for ways of making the input costs lower. We've got to try and see how we can make land cheaper, the cost of capital cheaper, the cost of goods and services cheaper. And there is a way to do that. And I'd like to show you how to do that. Now, we've got a problem. There's a huge unemployment problem here, so let's look at that first. They're all SMEs. They're all single enterprises, small enterprises. Each unemployed person is a potential small enterprise. Now, I'm going to assume that there's 5 million people out there who are currently unemployed and that they won't be employed. They won't find a job. That's the assumption I'm making here. If they find a job, that's fine. But I'm not very hopeful about that, and we just don't know. So it's better to plan for the worst. So we've got 5 million people. Now, if you haven't got a formal job, the only thing you can do is to work the land. That's what the Lord gave us for our sustenance. We don't need a job if we've got the land. So 5 million people, let's say they each need a hectare of land, means we're going to have to establish 150 villages. That is half the number of villages, half the number of municipalities there are in South Africa. And those are located where arable land is basically found. And each of those will have to have 35,000 hectares, 35,000 people, each having a hectare. The secret of farming, of course, is to use the power of nature. If you start a year with two rabbits, they should be of different sex, at the end of that year you will have 800 rabbits without really doing too much work. You have to fence them in, you have to give them some grass, but they will, that's 800 rabbits. I think they cost about 30 rand a rabbit now. A hand-raised Angora goat, of which you can raise two a year, is that so? I'm not sure that's true. Anyway, you can raise Angora goats, and if you really do it properly, if you really put a lot of work into them, the fleece is worth 136,000. I'm just giving you two examples of how bountiful the land is if you can only get to it. Now, in addition, you only need to spend 3 or 4 weeks a year growing the food for yourself. You need something like 200 square meters of that's a number of cricket pitches, that's all. So you've got to spend a month of your time growing your food and for your family. And it's an amazing thing. I'll give you this quote. How efficient a human labor is. This is from Mr. Felix Paturi, Nature Mother of Invention. If we convert the energy gained from harvested plants into kilowatt hours and compare it with the energy expended for that harvest, the result is startling. For 50 harvested energy units, the American farmer invests 250 fuel energy units, and the Chinese farmer only a single energy unit. This means that the countryman works in a deficiency of 5,000%, and the USA farmer, equipped with all the tractors and technical aids he needs, at an efficiency of 20%. So, we are a machine. Humans are machines. We're the most productive, most efficient of all machines. If you turn over the page, you'll see a little farm of which a typical 1 hectare farm Now, this has a 120 square meter house. It'll take one man 3 years to develop it on his own, using the materials on the property and planting, so that's the clay and the rocks, and growing the rest. Maybe he needs some straw for the roof. Hardly any capital cost. He doesn't chase cash crops. We used a quantity surveyor to do this investigation, and he said that is all that's needed. A chap can walk 3 years after getting occupation of his hectare. He can walk off with this estate. And he worked out every brick and every piece of pipe he had to lay down. How many vegetables? How many fences? How many fields he had to sow? Of course, he wouldn't do it on his own. You'd have in one of these 1,700 villages, as I say, the 150 villages, you'd get your building gangs, and they go around doing the various jobs in their building gangs. And so where is this 5 million hectares that we're looking for these 5 million unemployed? Well, according to Frost and Sullivan, who are a very big market research company, international research company, there are 27 million hectares of land in South Africa which is unused at the moment. What is its cost? This is the thing that boggles my mind. The average cost of an urban plot today in South Africa is 500,000 rand. According to ABSA, they do the statistics every month, every quarter. That's incredible. So I have to have 500,000 rand before I can even start thinking of buying a building a house. In the country, it's more. You won't find a hectare of land, a small holding in the country, for 500,000 rand. So let's just ask this question. Why does land have a cost? Can anybody tell me? I'm a valuer. I don't see it. It's not. It didn't cost anything. I don't think God put down a down payment because somebody's going to construct it. So why are we paying this money for this land? We've got the wrong pricing system. The thing is wrong. And the reason why it's wrong is what's gone wrong is that when we pay taxes, we don't pay it on the land, we pay it on our work, on our earnings, on our profits, on our interests, on the VAT. That's an incredible thing to be doing. And that's the reason why we have to pay to get access to land. The thing that holds everything for us, it's like a treasure chest. We just have, if we could just get land, we can make a decent life for ourselves. But we have to pay all this money. Now, what's worse is that these prices are terribly high in relation to the world. They are the highest prices in the world. Places like Hong Kong and Singapore, there is no land price. That land is owned by the state. You have to lease it. Now, if you look at this graph, I think on the next page, you'll see there, that's the price of houses, sourced to 100 in 1997, and there's 2009, so it's 12 years. There's the price of prices, in South Africa, and there they are in Singapore and Hong Kong. So it's not, we don't need house prices and land, because land prices are a proxy for house prices. We don't need high house prices and land prices to be good at, to have good growth. Hong Kong has a GDP of five times higher than ours. In South Africa, it hasn't got any minerals, hasn't got any water. The this is where it's wrong. So, I have invented this law. Apologies, I have invented this law. It's called the law of economic growth. It goes like this.
Economic growth
is stifled when taxes are levied on property, capital, and employment and trade, because these costs all rise. It will flourish under a land rent single tax, as they then all fall. We can go through it later if you wish.
But what we can do, what you
can do, and how you could help with this small, well,
apparently there's a challenge, because otherwise we won't be able to get the recording.
Sorry.
Of your voice. Thank you.
Do you want me to read that again?
Yes.
Would you like me to read that again? Okay, I won't. Yes, how you could help us would be within your cluster is to persuade Mr. Gordon to slowly but surely and gradually change the tax system so he taxes land only and relieves us of all the taxes on our personal, on our initiative, on our work, on our capital. It's sometimes known, and that's why my capitalist friends don't like it, this is the nationalization of land rent, not land. It's nationalizing the land rent and simultaneously privatizing work and savings and that and with untrade. No, this system is used, as I said, in Hong Kong. It's also used in Ethiopia, Botswana, and Mozambique, up to a certain extent. And Joshua Nkomo describes it very, very well, and this is what he says. We don't believe in trading land or selling land. No. And in any government that I lead, you can be certain these practices must go. That does not mean that we will be taking people's land. It means that other people who haven't got money will have a chance to use land, which is the common property of everybody. And if they have to pay some rates or rents, that will go to a general fund of the people, to the treasury. In this way, citizens can use as much land as they want. Our system is this. Once you use land, that land belongs to you. But you have not bought it. You cannot sell it. The land belongs to the people, but everything on that land is yours. What that really means is you can sell the building. You don't have to keep holding the land, but you sell your building. You say, right, I'm leaving now. I'm going to the city. That building is on a piece of land, and that piece of land is registered in your name. But the rent is being paid to the state. So the benefits that piece of land enjoys, the monetary benefits all go. So if I own a part of Cavendish Square as an investment, and somebody else owns a part of a house in Hanover Park, that person is benefiting from the beauty of the Cavendish Square shopping center and its position. We've all got a vested interest in each other's properties, whether they be in Clifton or in Mpumalanga. Now, this is actually what I've been calling to today is actually a constitutional imperative. At 25.5, section 25.5, it says the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to foster conditions which enable citizens to get access to land on an equitable basis. To our legal counsel, fostering conditions can easily mean changing to a new land pricing system. We're not expropriating land here. There's no land being expropriated. all we're saying is you pay for it what anybody else would pay for it on a monthly basis, on that rental. A few years ago, Trevor Manuel reduced the corporate taxes from 30% to 28% for the reason to create more jobs. Now, that's all that's really going to happen here. Mr. Gordon, all he needs to do is to gradually increase the rates we pay property tax anyway. We pay VAT, we pay transfer duty, we pay capital gains tax, we pay rates. All he's doing is he's saying, and if he was to agree to this, he's increasing the taxes on property, on land, and reducing the others simultaneously. Equitable means that gaining access to raw land must be affordable to everyone, and that means vacant land must become free of any entry or capital cost. That's what we're saying here. Let's do it properly. Let's have it so that if you're starving and you're desperate and you're desperate in your life, let you be able to take a hectare. And I think that's all I need to say. Thank you.
Mr. McKinn, you still had 2 minutes if you wanted to clarify further.
Sorry?
I'm saying you still had 2 minutes on your presentation if there's anything that you wanted to clarify.
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Thank you
very much for this kind of information through your presentation. I take it that members have heard. May we then interact with the presentation members? No comment from members? No clarity-seeking question? Nothing. Everything is clear. Free land. Is it something that is beyond our our understanding? May I get Mem Sotetsi? No, I know the protocol. Please. Mem Sotetsi?
Yeah, I think we'll have so many questions, but I appreciate, you know, the passion that the presenter has on the issue of land, the critical issue in our communities. You know, many people cannot afford to buy land. If you have to pay the price that is indicated here, it means they have money to buy material to build whatever they want to build. And if you had that land for free, and at some stage you just feel like going to maybe have an error, why sell the land if there isn't anything, I mean, for it these days? But the other question is, if you have developed that land, but maybe other members will interact with that. But we really appreciate the fact that we have people who support us on the issue of land. It's a critical issue in government. You know.
Thanks, Mansa Tese, Madam Minister.
No, thanks, Chair. Maybe they are not, there's no many questions, because I think part of the issues, they are actually talking to the current problem. But and though not mentioned here, but it talks to the willing buyer, willing seller type of policy. And I think that has been alluded to even by government, that it is not a good system. We need to look at what can be other measures that we have to look at. And but given that, is that part of the issues are part of the constitutional negotiations that we had to come to. But as well, I mean, after 16 years, then it seems there are a lot of issues that need to be looked at in terms of changing that some of the unintended consequences. And it's true that the land, the government possesses some land, but the bulk of the land is with the private people, and they're charging government an arm and a leg, I mean, for buying back that land. But the question of the expropriation bill, I think it was introduced to us at state parliament, but it was withdrawn. And there were some of the clauses that had to be looked at, I think. So what comes out of the presentation, I can say that it then talks to that issue to say, let's deal with that particular bill as a matter of agency and make sure that we can deal with a lot of issues that are a stumbling block in terms of growth and other issues that are related to. But I'm sure part of the things, I mean, as the presenter says, it is as they are. Well, the Ricardo mentioned is quite interesting as to how he classified man-made, etc., and all those issues, and nationalizing the rents and other issues. So it's quite interesting. But the long and short, I think, that I can say into this input, I mean, it's just saying the current problems we have, it means it's shared by many people, and we need to do something about it as a developmental state to achieve what we want to achieve. That it means we have to look at these issues differently, because for small business people, it's quite problematic then to afford sale of land and where you want to have your small business, whatever. So it is true, part of the issues that are raised here, but I can take it as a work in progress in terms of government side, because these have been looked at, and surely they are creating a problem going forward. And yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Deputy Minister. I guess this will, as the minister is saying, this is part of her work, I guess, also of ensuring that we develop small and medium enterprises. And this has been an issue in South Africa, and we all know it's not only in South Africa, everywhere else. Land is a very, very important commodity, and we cannot really... we have to look at means and ways of ensuring that we economically utilize it to the benefit of the people. I think the issues raised here are very clear. And as the minister and Mamsotis are saying, these are very, issues very critical to any human development. And not only about development, but also dignity of the people. And these are some of the constitutional imperatives. Imperative areas that the government is busy with. I think there's a lot of wisdom in this presentation, and obviously it needs to be looked into, especially around issues related to taxations and so forth. Thank you very much, Mr. Micken, for the presentation. If you have anything to say, I still have a lot of time for yourself. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to. I would like to say yes. This is a very different way of looking at things, but it's not something to be ashamed of in any way. it's quite a wonderful idea. So it goes right back to the Old Testament, actually. I mean, it's a well-known phenomenon that the taxes on your work and your labor and your VAT are regressive. They make things more expensive. But I would just like to take issue with you. Well, not take issue with you. How can I take issue with you, Deputy Minister? This question of the willing seller, willing buyer, is a very, I'm going to just read something to you here about this, what it says this, about this in the Constitution, because it's not as, I believe the Constitution has got it right. I don't think there's any problem with what the Constitution says. When you're going to expropriate something, and we're not expropriating anything here, we're just taking a land rent. Land rent is because it's on a road, or it has a view, or the land is very rich and the weather is good. It's not, it's nothing of anybody else's work. We have to distinguish between the suit. It's 99% human labor, but it's 10%. It's a wool. It's a lamb walked around and ate some. Who invented sheep? But let me just get back to that. We're not doing expropriation, but if we were, this is what it says. The amount of compensation and the time and manner of payment must be made just and equitable. But you must also take into account the extent of direct state investment and subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property. Now, that saying, as a valuer, this is what it means to me, is that that piece of land in Langa has got a road access to Cape Town, to the CBD. It's got a school close by. It's got a nice view of the mountain. Whether it's how safe it is, I don't know. But there are aspects of that piece of land. The value of it depends entirely on infrastructure and nature. So when you come to a farm outside Riversdale, the same thing applies. Surely. The same thing, that the extent of direct state investment and subsidy. Land prices are a subsidy. You know, if you tax the land fully, there wouldn't be any land price. That's just the mathematical truth. So that farm outside Riversdale relies, leaving out the improvements now, because that's somebody else's, that's the owner's property. I mean, well, the land is the owner's property, but the thing that really came to him because of his own work, or somebody before him, that's man-made. What I mean is, there's land which is nature's endowment, and then there's a part of it which is man-made, the fences and the dams. Now, what it says is, if you're going to expropriate, you must deduct the value of the direct state investment and subsidy. So if it's an unimproved piece of land, according to this constitution, I deal with valuations all the time. That if I was asked if you were to, in an expropriation matter, if I was called to an expropriation matter in front of a judge, and I had to explain to him what my valuation was, I'd say to him, look, there is no value to that raw land because it has as its value been given the roads, given the facility, given the dams, given the closeness to a town or a market or a port or an airport. So I don't think this willing seller and willing buyer story, I don't think it's the end of it. To me, the Constitution says it quite clearly. But then as I just come back again and just emphasize, we're not, this idea of just changing the tax rate to places is not expropriation. If you've got a vacant farm, it'll hurt you. If you've got a farm which is running and full and you know it's got all you can use on it, then that's obviously different. But if a vacant farm, under the new tax system would be so taxed that you'd have to use it. That 27 million hectares, it would have to be used. A farmer would not sit on his land and not use it if he knew if he was being charged what anybody else would pay for it. Does that clarify that?
No, it does certainly, Mr. McKinn. Thank you very much. I think the Deputy Minister was just making reference to the fact that the policy as it stands, it needs to be reviewed. That's what she was saying.
Okay.
Not that we neglect it or we do away with it completely. Something that is, you know, within the government and is receiving attention.
Okay.
Within.
Okay. Yes. May I ask, Madam Chair, would you speak to Mr. Gordon about this, please?
There's a committee responsible for finance. And yes, as Economic Development Committee, we all sort of overall, we do interact with other committees if we have anything to say to them.
Can you grab him by the neck and say, come on?
Well. As I said, there's a lot of wisdom in this, and we will definitely look into that and see how far we go to. But these are the issues that are busy, are within our that the government is busy with, together with Parliament, I guess. Thank you very much, Mr. McKinn, and I don't know if we need a tea break or comfort break. Can we take a 5 minutes comfort break? Oh, okay. Deputy Minister, thank you very much for your presence here. We did not expect you to be here. This shows that you are still in touch, and we really appreciate that. Time spent with us, we really appreciate. All the best in your work. Otherwise, can we have that 5 minutes comfort break? We come back. What's the time? 9:30. Can we come back at 25:45?
Hey. Thank you. looking at that
Lanto Tese, we want to comment on this. Can we reconvene, okay? Thank you very much. Members, we now considering a presentation from Ntshongolanga Management Services. And that will be presented by Mr. Donovan Muirhead. Is that, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Muirhead. Muirhead, yes.
Thank you. I didn't get the name for the lady.
It's Caroline Ongersbach.
Thank you very much. You're welcome, and may I hand over to you?
Okay. Honorable Chairperson, committee members, esteemed associates, on behalf of Ntshongolanga Management Services and the National Accommodation Association of South Africa, we would like to thank you for affording us...
Sorry, Mr. Muirhead, is it Ntshongolanga?
Ntshongolanga, yes.
I recall. Why did you write this? I was wondering what does this mean. Ntshongolanga, yes.
Ntshongolanga.
Okay. West.
May I continue? Okay. Again, we'd like to thank you for affording us the opportunity to present our frustrations and our clients' frustrations in respect of SMME access to funding, especially in particular within the tourism industry. Our presentation is in two parts, the first of being the challenges of what as industry support services face, and the second part being that of actual clients themselves, which will be presented by my associate, Ms. Caroline Mungersbrook, on behalf of the National Accommodation Association of South Africa. Ntshongolanga Management Services is a national specialist hospitality consulting and management company, specifically designed, geared, and focused on providing turnkey solutions to the small, medium, and micro enterprises within the tourism industry. Our range of services include consulting, mentorship, administration services, sales and marketing services, and in particular, workplace skills development. Each of our services is focused on providing a one-stop turnkey solution to our clients by applying the five pillars of business. In line with the five pillars of business, we've developed a tourism business incubator program designed to accelerate the successful development of identified business ventures through an array of business support services, resources, and mentorship processes. Within our sector, there are approximately 28,000 registered establishments, of which 290,000 people are directly employed. There are 389,000 indirect employees, which represent approximately 96% of those are SMEs. In total there, you'll notice though that a very large percentage of the workforce population is presented by SMEs. Our current common practices. Although there are numerous programs available for our sector, as turnkey consultants who add a wealth of experience, knowledge and support to these businesses, we cannot access these funding programs. Nor are we seen as credible business entities by the financial institutions, often sent from pillar to post, with empty promises and unrealistic expectations. For example, we approached the Department of Tourism with our Tourism Business Incubator program to see if it's a viable program, if it's a program that will work in South Africa. They agreed that with the program is effective and will be a huge benefit to our sector. However, they did have certain reservations, which we have addressed. The National Department of Tourism then recommended that we approach a tourism enterprise partnership for funding assistance with this program, even requesting a meeting on our behalf with TEP. This was at the beginning of September. We've received acknowledgement that they've received our request for a meeting, but since then no further correspondence has been received, even after numerous reminder emails and telephone calls. Our recommendations. The business needs to be recognized and rewarded for the essential services they provide through access to finance and funding. What we are proposing is a private-public equity fund. It's the most functional type of funding opportunity that we've identified. And through this private equity fund, we find that it will assist us in developing and mentoring and growing these small businesses in a sector which is the fastest growing sector within South Africa. In principle, the program can be utilized in a number of sectors and can be aimed at funding numerous activities, with financing being made available from between 50,000 to 500,000 Rand with clearly defined exit strategies and activity benchmarking in place. What we believe the foundation qualifying criteria should be that the entity must be owner-run, must employ at least 3 employees and have been in operation for a minimum of 6 months and have long-term contracts in place. The projected annual turnover should be less than 2 million Rand. Upon program completion, the entity is to have created a further 3 employment opportunities and have achieved agreed milestones, along with contributing non-financial resources to community development projects and upliftment. Investment returns and risk. The investment returns should be paid quarterly and based on turnover and cash flow allowances. This business to ensure effective business and financial generally accepted accounting practices. This, along with milestone tranche investment payouts, ensures that risk exposure is minimalized. The application process. Application process should be no longer than 90 days from application date to the initial payout if accepted. Applicant must provide detailed business plan with realistic assumptions and financial projections. Original certified copies of all long-term contracts, 6 months bank statements, tax clearance certificates, and FICA. The program can be managed and administered through current existing platforms such as CEDA. Thank you for affording me the opportunity. I'm now going to hand over to Ms. Caroline Ungersbrook, who will then take you through the remainder of the presentation. Thank you.
Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Committee Members, on behalf of the National Accommodation Association of South Africa, we would like to thank you for affording us the opportunity to present our comments on the SME access to funding. The NAA is an association that is represented in all provinces. We represent the smaller accommodation industry that covers the guest houses, bed and breakfast, self-catering accommodation, lodges, backpackers, and also homestays. However, the purpose of the presentation, I will refer to the guest house industry as the guest house industry. There are 3 tiers to the National Accommodation Association of South Africa. There's the local accommodation associations, then the provincial associations, which are made up of the local associations, and then there's the national body. The local associations are the immediate support structure. As an example, in Johannesburg, in Gauteng, there are 12 associations, and out of those 12 associations, there are smaller, local, very localized associations within those associations. And it's a support structure that we've got a lot of bookings in a guest house or an establishment, we can then pass on to the nearest establishment of the same, and we can also offer mentorship and advice, and it really, really, really works well. The association was designed in such a manner that the individual property owner has a voice. We have over 1,200 members countrywide, and we mentor homestays in some of the provinces, and we're busy working on increasing that base. We are associate members of FedHASA and SASA, and we have a seat on the board of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa and CETA. We also work closely with the Tourism Grading Council of South Africa. According to the Tourism Grading Council of South Africa, as of July 2010, 67,698 rooms are non-hotel accommodation, which includes the guest houses, bed and breakfast, self-catering, and lodges. In the hotel accommodation, there are 43,518 rooms. What one can see by this is that the small SME market is, facilities is quite a large one. And these are just the graded properties. It was referred to earlier that there were 28,000 establishments. The non-hotel accommodation industry is generally self-funded. You have your property and you want to add on some more rooms, then you go to the bank. And the hotel groups are generally equity funded. I think they've got a nice budget. It's something like 650,000 rand per room as a budget. The guest houses that are graded are generally compliant. However, there are many properties that don't have all the compliances in place, as there are hindrances. Those difficulties are due to the inefficient local municipalities and the access to funding. We as the NAA in South Africa request that all our members are compliant. They need to obtain the adequate hospitality insurance. They need to comply with the relevant fire regulations. They need to pay SAM road fees. They need to pay SAM pro fees. They need to pay the correct TV licenses, obtain a food compliance certificate or a health certificate, comply with the labor law and the basic conditions of employment act, obtain a liquor license, keep a set of accounts, register as a provisional taxpayer, register with the local and provincial tourism authorities, get graded with the Tourism Grading Council of South Africa, and comply with the Immigration Act by keeping a register of guests. There's a huge cost to the compliance. And most businesses understand the benefits of regulation for the protection of their own businesses and that of their patrons. And we have a problem with access to information. Being quite an informal type of business or sector, what normally happens is somebody's got a room in their house and they go, okay, I'd like to start a guest house or a bed and breakfast or a homestay. And it's successful because people like informal accommodation. Then they want to grow bigger. So whilst there are opportunities for access to funding, the access to the information to access funding is almost non-existent. We can get funding through the DTI, TEP, NEP, RDC, and obviously the banks. But most applicants don't meet the minimum qualifying requirements for the bigger organisations. Most applicants aren't given enough information to make an informed decision. When a guest house only goes to the bank to borrow money to expand or to become compliant, they first go to the home loans department. The home loans department says, yeah, but this is not really a home loan. We'll send you to the commercial section of the bank. So then the commercial section of the bank goes, no, but it's still your home that you're expanding. And so people are saying from pillar to post, which is quite frustrating. Some banks don't even want to finance guest houses as they don't understand the industry. And I think that's really the key issue here, is that the industry isn't really understood. It is important to mention that most guest houses have an average of 5 rooms and employ an average of 3 personnel. If the graded non-hotel accommodation industry is 15% greater than the hotel industry, it is safe to say that we are one of the largest contributors to the job market in South Africa. There's a new thing coming out by the Department of Tourism. The Department of Tourism, together with the SAVS, are in the process of finalising a minimum criteria for sustainable tourism for the tourism industry. The tourism industry has been set a challenge to become more responsible. As establishments, we've been asked to use less electricity. We need to change the light fixings and the light bulbs. We need to install solar power geysers. We need to install heat pumps instead of air conditioners. We need to install inverters and generators. We also need to separate waste, and that comes with an expense of its own. You need to have separate bins. You need to for paper, for glass, for tins, for wet waste. And we also need to use water efficiently. We need to install shower heads that save water and electricity. We need to put in systems to sort out grey water, your bath water and the shower water. And then also look at rain harvesting and water collection tanks. Whilst the government asks us to save the water and electricity and we install the above-mentioned systems, we will get rebates. The rebate system is time-consuming and in some cases is non-existent due to minimum criteria. For a small non-hotel accommodation property to want to become fully compliant with the new criteria that will be launched in April 2011, the cost could be in the region of 250,000 rand. Most property owners would be unable to finance these initiatives. The banks do not see the value in funding such initiatives. The banks would make money, and the property would save money on the reduced monthly utility bills, and we would be responsible in tourism, as well as being responsible citizens. Our general recommendation is that government and the sector needs to form stronger public-private partnerships which allow for funding and financing to be made available through knowledgeable, experienced industry programs. We urge you to communicate with us, the NAA of South Africa, and other stakeholders in the accommodation industry. The NAA SA represents a vast number of the SMMEs, as I've indicated earlier. One of the most difficult challenges that the non-hotel accommodation industry face is to be taken seriously. We recommend that the government and the government institutions, together with the larger banking sector, create a small division that understands our sector of the hospitality and the tourism industry. We recommend that the government and the government institutions, together with the larger banks in the banking sector, create a small division. Oh, I've already gone there. But now, perhaps a special program needs to be introduced which encourages businesses to promote green initiatives through the sector and the general population as a whole. We need to set structures to have access to finance in different categories, starting with 50,000 rand through to over and above a quarter of a million rand. Qualifying criteria would obviously also need to be in place. We urge all participants in the Sustainable and Responsible Tourism Program, as well as the DTI, IDC, TP, NDT and banks, together with the tourism associations such as ours, to communicate a way forward. We are at the forefront and can communicate to the individual property owners. In closing, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, on behalf of the NAASA, we thank you once again for affording us the opportunity to present to the committee, and we look forward to further communication and a way forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ongus Bosch. Thank you very much for the presentation together with Mr. Muirhead. I guess it's a straightforward presentation, members. Can we interact with it? Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Obviously, you know, what comes through is often the difficulty to find finance for these projects. Now, government and institutions that we've got, like SAMAF, like KULA, like IDC, is already there in terms of financing, National Empowerment Fund, etc. To what extent was that option been, you know, have you looked into that? Have you spoken to government about that? Because surely those institutions, not only within economic development, but also Department of Trade and Industry, should be in a position to finance small business development. And it seems like you're finding difficulties. One of the arguments why those institutions exist is exactly because it's sometimes very, very difficult to find finance and proper finance in the commercial banking industry. Have you looked at those options that are available, and what are the specific stumbling blocks or bottlenecks or issues and concerns that you've experienced? Because that is surely where we must come in and try to unblock those issues and problems, because we have also identified, Madam Chair, that small business and entrepreneurship is where we will be able to create jobs exponentially, not in the formal sector. Thank you very much.
Sorry for that, Mr. Mara, thank you very much. Mr. Kwabasa?
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. I want to start by commenting that, you know, the hospitality and tourism industry, one assumes, is a very well-known kind of industry. And it is shocking to hear that this industry is not understood by those who are supposed to finance it. One would have understood if, for instance, you went to the bank and you are in a rural area, you are establishing yourself there, and the bank would say, yeah, well, you don't own the land, because the land is communal, it's under the chief, because that is still a problem which has not been resolved up to now. But and perhaps that is one of the observations I want to make, and see whether perhaps that is one of the problems. But it is difficult, Chairperson, to understand why people go to the lodges and all these small, nice houses and spend time there, leisure and everything else, including banks, including some of us, including officials of departments. But when it comes to funding, they don't understand it. What it is that you are not saying to them. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Mr. Kovasa. Ma'am, for this.
Thank you, Chairperson. Under a qualifying criteria, here with information that a person must have been in operation for 6 months, we're convinced that 6 months is enough time for one to be at the level that is the standard, you know, level of operation that a person qualifies for your assistance. And almost the same question like Member Murray, that when you talk of hindrances, what are you actually talking about so that you can be able to assist where possible? And about the inefficient local municipalities that cannot, you know, assist people in finding that do applicants meet the requirements as set by the particular municipality or the potential funder. And the DTI, TP, and the IGC, these funding agencies, I mean, they've been there for some time now, and from time to time they're in the newspapers. We understand that not everyone reads newspapers, but someone who does marketing must find some, you know, some ways and means to disseminate information to the particular applicants. And to say most applicants don't meet the minimum qualifying criteria. What is that minimum criteria that you're talking about?
Thanks, Ma'am Professor. Ma'am Pengu, are you fine? Okay. That's all. Okay. Can I hand over to you and then I'll ask afterwards?
Thank you very much for your questions. Yes, to answer the very first question, to what extent have we addressed the issues with the financial institutions and the financial suppliers such as DTI, TIP, and the like, is that they come up with a whole host of, they do not understand the small tourism entity. They're classifying the guest house with a hotel. You go and stay at a hotel, you room number 517. But you go to a guest house, you're Mr. Smith from Cape Town, that's got five kids, the one kid was in hospital last week, how is he feeling? That's the type of relationship. You get a different standard of service. You get a different quality of actual product that you're getting. And the financial institutions, unfortunately, do not recognize the difference. And in terms of the actual process of applying, 9 out of 10 times, because you're a very small business, you're essentially wearing 4 or 5 different hats. Whereas in the hotel, you've got your finance department who deals with the finance, you've got your general manager who oversees everything, you've got your operations director, you've got your rooms, you've got your food and beverage. In a smaller type of establishment, you literally have to wear multiple caps to do all the work. Now, to still go through and go through the application process, and if you've seen the application process for some of these things, if you've seen the application process, say, for example, with the National Empowerment Fund, that just to write the business plan alone is a nightmare. So you pay a consultant 10 to 15,000 rand to write the business plan for you. The problem is the consultant does not know anything about the industry. So he writes a generic financial business plan which has no actual relevance to the industry or the sector that is taken into consideration. Then we've got the lengthy application process. Then we've got the promises and the resetting of the bar, so to speak, with the financial institutions and with these funding institutions saying, right, you meet with this criteria, however, we need you to come up with this. You meet that criteria, they raise the bar again. So they're constantly raising the bar. And all that while the business is going under because they can't have access to their funds. They're not asking for the funds to go on holiday to Honolulu. They're asking for that money so they can grow and develop their business. A lot of the programs that are out there, we have got members that have benefited greatly from them. However, by the time the money comes around, it purely just assists them with cash flow for that period of time. Unfortunately, the financial institutions do not recognize the value of the cash flow for the small business, and I think that is one of the fundamental issues that is not addressed, is the value of cash flow requiring for that business to continually operate from a month-to-month basis. Because essentially, what a small business is operating on cash flow from month-to-month, and then they lose out on the fifth fundamental pillar of business, which is business growth and development. To answer Mr. Okay, I think that pretty much answered the first and second question. To answer Ms. Tosetti's question on why 6 months, we find in what we've done and within ourselves as well is that the 6 month time, that's where you actually require the funds the most for your business. Because now you've developed and you've marketed your business, so you've developed your niche market. You've got your long-term contracts in place. You're delivering on your long-term contracts. However, now for that business to grow and develop, and for it to set its platform, if you follow a trend line analysis of how these businesses go, it's after those 6 months, it starts coming, the dip starts occurring, and that dip starts going and going and going, and that's where it starts eating into your cash flow reserves. And that's why it's very important that if there's a support infrastructure, we're not saying give us the money, we're saying just provide us with the support so that we can go and access these things to help move the trend line instead of starting to dip, to, you know, stabilize and start moving upwards again. And everyone, I think, this is dealing with the specific hindrances. I'm sure Caroline is not saying anything.
The hindrances with to just even get compliance. Every municipality has got different bylaws. And to understand those bylaws, you really, really need to be well educated. And once again, the guest house industry is quite an informal industry. Okay, it's just it's hospitality, and the normal layperson goes through to the municipality and says, "Right, please, I need fire, I need the fire certificate. I need a health certificate." It's difficult to get anybody out to come and see your property to actually sign off a fire regulations and to sign off the health certificate. And sometimes we've had some of our members go to the municipality and they say, "Oh, well, if you just give us R500, we'll just sign it off," and without them actually coming to see the property. And that in itself is quite dangerous for the guest that's going to be staying on that property. So that's what we're finding really, really, really difficult, is that the bylaws are all different, but that's acceptable, and that there isn't the personnel to actually come out to the properties to give the relevant certifications.
Sorry, if I can just add one more thing. That also, one thing that we found is the different municipalities and the different departments within the local and provincial governments are not speaking to each other on what activities and processes. And I take, for example, the Tourism Service Excellence Initiative is currently in the process of being rolled out by the Departments of Tourism. However, CETA, in developing the sector skills plan, did not take into account the Tourism Service Excellence Initiative and what skills programs need to be produced for the sector, particularly for the small businesses where you wear the many hats, to develop on it. However, we are pleased to note we did address that with CETA, and they have amended that in their sector skills plan. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. I just want to find out, there's a general outcry from the previously disadvantaged communities that this organization, especially dealing with the accommodation issues, and generally within tourism sector as a whole, is really not transformed. And seem to be using these associations and to really cap other, people from participating. How true is it, and how far do you extend your services? For instance, do you have any membership in the township, and how broad, how representative is that, so that you can gauge all those issues? And in terms of the proposal you're coming up with to the department, I can understand this. I do understand this from the perspective that you want equity from, equity funding from government. And you're putting here some of the proposals in terms of access to that fund. How do you think this fund is going to assist, especially a person in the rural area who doesn't have the type of knowledge that you have? You just said that, the documents themselves, I have seen some of them, the bulk of, for a guest house. Open a guest house, you need a whole lot of things, negotiations with the, neighbors, all those things, especially from the municipality, differing, of course, from municipality to municipality. But in the rural area where a person doesn't know, but the person, has a passion to develop, to establish a guest house, but has not gone to school to be able to understand and read that and read those papers. how do you think, for instance, through this initiative that you're coming up with, do you think that person will really benefit from that scheme that you come, I mean the the equity fund you're coming up with, or model of funding that you're coming up with? The other issue is also around, because you are also sort of training, assisting in building capacity within the sector, Mr. Muhead. How do you think also, because I don't think you have accessed those areas in terms of the type of work that you are doing, and this is where government wants to go, for instance. And that's where many tourists, even including local tourists, want to, you know, go to, so that they understand the culture and all other things related to that. I just want you to expatiate further in that, so that we don't see you only talking to urban areas, semi-urban. Can you just explain to us in terms of the work you're doing?
From the membership point of view, we are established in all the provinces, and what we've done over the past year and what we are busy building on is a mentor program for how do I say that? So that we can guide people in the disadvantaged areas on how to run a guest house, do the kind of workshops. And so to, as a mentor, you go to their establishments and spend like 2 or 3 hours a week with them, and you can just to impart some of the information. We have paid up members in Soweto, Guguletu, what's the one in Durban, Tembisa. We do have members, and they're quite strong members. And it's growing. It's a growing base, because what we try to achieve as the Accommodation Association is also to gather as much information as possible so that we can impart that information across and grow that part of the industry.
To revert back to your question about the equity funding model, the equity funding model is purely to provide a platform for the support service provider. So that's your specific hospitality bookkeepers, because to keep a set of accounts for a guest house and a bed and breakfast is totally different than any other business, because you've got so many different factors. You've got production, plus you've got service, you've got cost of sales. It really is complex. So it's purely to provide a platform for that. To address the issue in terms of the holistic skills development, that's where the program such as the Tourism Business Incubator program comes into play. Now, we know for a fact, if you go to Porfada, was it Porfada that city over there? Mm-hmm. You're lucky if you come across a Protea hotel, and the maximum amount of rooms there is 35. However, there are 17 different guest houses and bed and breakfasts within that area that range from 3-star all the way up to 5-star quality type of establishments. Now, if you do your ratios, you'll see that they actually employ more people within that local community than what the actual Protea hotel does. What the Tourism Business Incubator Program does is it literally, as the program says, it provides an incubator for the business for, we originally said 18-month period, the Department of Tourism wanted 5 years, so we increased it and we made it a 5-year program, where they literally, we hold your hand through the process of going through, providing skills development, support services, sales and marketing, which is essentially what the industry is all about. Cash flow management, essential part of any SME is cash flow management. And that's where programs such as the Tourism Business Incubator Program is the ideal solution for the tourism industry in those, especially in those rural communities where you identify an experienced guest house, and that's what, you know, working in conjunction with the NAA, and it's, they have the experience. They've been doing this for the last 15 years. They know the ins and outs. They know that you go to Checkers, and if you buy your stock from Checkers, you get 10% discount. But you buy your stock from Pick and Pay, and you're paying actually more. You know, where do you get your goods? Where do you get your linen from? Where do you, you know, it's all about cost. It's all about cost flow management, cash flow management, and skills development. Because the best way that we've found with the Tourism Business Incubator Program to transfer skills is by practical experience. And part and parcel of the Tourism Business Incubator Program is you actually go through what is known as a simulation model, where you literally, within the period of 5 days through the initial program, and each month that you set up a different program, you go through simulation models where you make decisions on marketing. And based on the competition in the area, your decision made does not only help your establishment, but it helps the establishments around, or has a negative effect and actually declines in the markets within that area. So that's, you know, in terms of skills development, transferring skills, the best and the only way, you can go and get college degrees, you can go and get qualifications, but nothing actually works for the experience that you gain from actually doing it.
Thanks, Mr. Mihad. What's your joining fee? The association joining fee or the NAA joining fee?
300 Rand and 80 Rand a room for the year.
80 Rand per room.
Yes.
So if you have three rooms,
it's 80 times 3 plus 300.
And that does that include the... There's a new type of hotel that, what do they call it? The one that develops from a guest house?
Homestead.
It's a homestead?
No, what we believe also developing a finance program where we would be able to get homestays into our association at no cost, funded.
Okay. Any other follow-up? We're done. Thank you very much for the presentation and also for the responses that you've given us. The presentation is noted by the committee, and we wish you all the best in your work. Thanks. The next presentation will be from Battle Bay Trading, and that will be presented by Mr. Thabang Moropa. Is he now here? Okay. Over to you, Mr. Moropa. You're not alone. You'll then introduce your colleague to us, because I don't have the name.
Yeah. Honorable Chairperson, esteemed members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Thabang Moropa from Battle Bay Trading. With me is my colleague, Komodo Silokane, and we will be presenting to you our view on SMEs and access to finance in the SME market. I would like to hand over to Komodo to give us the presentation. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, committee members, ladies and gentlemen, at Battle Bay, we are not here to try and give you an overview of the economic platform or how the economic status of South Africa is. It's something that I'm sure you're quite aware of. But we will try and come from the view of entrepreneurs as we are young entrepreneurs ourselves. We have done a lot of research predominantly on the issue of what are the things that are lacking as entrepreneurs or especially small, medium enterprises, and how we can then try and fix it going forward. Battle Bay as itself is obviously a black-owned, black-controlled business that looks to establish an arm that will assist black or SMMEs in general in South Africa to access funding. Funding, looking at a few of the models that have been out there, and I think one of our fundamental sort of core competencies has been within the structure of black economic empowerment, coming from a transformation perspective, trying to drive transformation in this economy. And looking at this particular model that South Africa has taken on and has been promulgated in 2007, and identifying where this particular model came from, we looked at the Malaysian model, which was one of the models that it was aligned to, or it was sort of mimicked by. And they were doing certain things that had assisted them to grow as an economy. Predominantly, their focus was on SME growth, on bringing out venture and capital funds and seed capital that would look at assisting SMEs. But from an academic perspective, our biggest issue, obviously, in developing countries and emerging markets has been that there has been a great deal of lack of access to finance, a lack of formal knowledge by entrepreneurs, and we all know that, a lack of understanding of their particular markets, understanding the environment that we're looking at as SMEs. And that has been, it has limited the growth of SMEs, but it has also been, I think, a disability, because no one has actually said, although we all know that these are the issues, we've never said, let's try and focus on them and fix them going forward. One of the other commonly cited barriers for economic development in emerging markets has been that the access to capital in terms of quantity of available capital and the quality therefore in terms of the finance that was offered. And it has been experienced in South Africa, and not just here, but also in the rest of Africa, where predominantly there has been a lack of internally generated funds and retained earnings and informal service. So SMEs, because of that particular issue, did not really know how to access the funding, and they would be assisted generally by their friends and family and informal lenders, but they could never go to the formal market to access these funds. This was a survey that was conducted independently by the National Youth Development Agency, and it came out two, 3 weeks ago, and it shows exactly what we're talking about, that the funding that has been going towards the small, medium enterprises has come predominantly from either their own capital, so when they leave the workplace, they've saved up their little war chest and saying that this is what we're going to use going forward, or family members or friends or other business owners. But it has been very limited when it comes to formal banking institutions, and because of a few major reasons. We identified that the gaps that were there were evident, that the smaller guys have your micro-lending and your seed capital that comes from associations, but the biggest issue was that middle gap. And that middle gap was what in most economies has been seen to drive economies, because they're innovative, they create jobs, and they drive a good percentage of the economy, because they are the bulk of the companies that sit here. There was a study that was done in terms of the corporates that sit within South Africa. I think most of you might be familiar with the exempt microenterprise and the generic scorecards of the Black Economic Empowerment Code, but that the bulk of the companies that sit in South Africa sit just under the 35 million rand turnover mark. So we're looking at the exempt startups, but predominantly the QSEs, which are between 5 and 35 million rand turnover annually, and these are normally family-owned businesses and all of that. But that is where we're trying, that is the gap that we're trying to assist. Not saying that we're forgetting about the exempt microenterprises or the companies with a turnover below 5 million. The demand for funds, obviously, from, and this is reiterating what I was talking about now, is the larger companies or the national, the multinational companies, and the micro enterprises that sit within the informal sector have certain leverages. So they give seed capital, microcredit, and with the larger companies, private equity funds and foreign direct investments are more than willing to assist at that gap. It's the problem is the missing gap are the small medium enterprises that need that assistance. We're looking at the main target of people, so we're looking at the private sector as well as the financing instruments that would be used therefore. And we're looking at the micro or sort of the short-term needs which come from the form of microfinancing and the medium and long-term needs which come from the banks. But again, we have an issue with that targeted area where there's no one that is bridging that gap. What are the issues? The issues are predominantly, I mean, if we look at the quote that was said by our former president, Nelson Mandela, this was in 1995, where he said, "My government, I am aware of the obstacles that have been prevailed small businesses. Historical injustice which prevented the majority of South Africans from gaining access to finance and other resources, restricted their access to major markets, and indeed prevented millions of people from becoming entrepreneurs. These practices have resulted in and what is now a very distorted economy in which so many small businesses and black businesses are confined to the margins of economic activity." This was in 1995, ladies and gentlemen. And 15 years later, our current president said at the national or his State of Nation address the same thing, that there needs to be focus on SMME development within this country. So we realize that we need to take cognizance that there has been a lack of improvement. I'm not saying that nothing has been done, but it is not a major improvement within the economy. Improving the access of finance for small and medium enterprises is crucial in fostering entrepreneurship, and we know that. It is crucial in competition within the economy. It is crucial for innovation and the growth of South Africa. Access to sufficient and adequate capital to grow and further develop these activities is difficultly faced by most South African SMME. Moreover, SMME need to meet the challenge of adapting to the changing financial environment and increasing complexity to the extent of financial reporting. So I'm not here to give you the doom and gloom of what's going on. It is there. It is something that we've all experienced. Let's try and find a way forward. We've broken it down in terms of the demand that is out there, and then we will look at the supply going forward. So the demand of diverse needs by firms or growth cycles as well as the size. So startups either bring in their own savings or they have venture capital funds that believe in them. There are a lot of angel funds out there. There are a lot of enterprise development from a BE perspective, companies trying to meet their BE quotas that might assist startups. But again, that is also a problem. They need working capital. There's bridge financing that is required. We have discounting received on trade credits. And most companies need financing for expansion, so reinvestment. They either use reinvestment of profits or they look at term lending or the private equity space. So when we look at the macroeconomic framework, the situation currently is thus. Finance constrained to narrow segments, resistance against the reduction of inequalities, The possible actions that we're looking at is support of government implementing expansion of support-based economic empowerment policy, but focusing predominantly on that middle sector. When we look at legal and regulatory framework, one of the things that we've seen that has curbed especially the smaller guys from getting some form of collateral or security has been, in actual fact, the PFMA. Section 66 of the PFMA states that they are not, as a provincial government or municipal government, you're not allowed to agree to any sort of guarantee, surety, or any session of an invoice unless it is formally advised by the MEC or the minister. That in itself has been a problem for SME. They can't take whatever tender they are awarded, they can't take whatever invoice that comes and cede it. And because they do not have their own collateral and surety, that then becomes a huge problem. So this is something that we're saying, look at the legal and regulatory framework and say, how can we fix it going forward? The infrastructure of financial markets. So there's a lack of secured information about SMMEs. When you're trying to find information of how the SMME have grown, what is going on within it, the information out there is done ad hoc. The NYDA will do it, Kula will do it, but there's nothing comprehensive that is being done saying this is the market and this is what's going on and this is how we can fix it going forward. Issues that are also looked at were credit scoring. They're ridiculous, especially for SME. They can't achieve them. External rating, the credit bureau. So most entrepreneurs are people that have either left the workplace, and we all know it. The first 6 months of any business is the lag phase. There's no way, obviously, that if you have not saved up your war chest or you haven't had an injection from a venture capitalist or some sort of funding, there is no way that you're going to meet the demands of your day-to-day liabilities. Hence, your credit rating will be skewed, and that in itself is not assisting the SMME. Commercial banks, SME finance is not a natural, profitable segment for banks. We all know that. The return on investment is low. They have no surety of how they're going to pay back. They can't guarantee any of that. And this, again, goes back to saying we need to look at integrated assistance from banks and the private sector as well as government to look at refinancing availability of medium-term funds or guarantees or even designing private equity funds. The speakers before us mentioned that the issue of private equity funds, which is quite important. Advise on risk and analysis, because that's where the problem with most SMEs is, that they have a limited amount of risk analysis and they don't know how to reduce their own internal costs. The venture capital. Venture capital is something that, again, depends on how it is looked at. There are, like I said, the angel funds. There's certain institutions that are out there that look at venture capital. There's very few that are willing to give a startup venture capital unless it's in an innovative space, the science or technology space, or a space that is looked at as with high guarantee of return of investment. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. So what do we suggest, ladies and gentlemen? This is what we suggest. It's very colorful, but I'll try and go through it. So we suggest that national, provincial, and local government bring into a two-prong approach. The two-prong approach will look at internally within either corporate or within national, provincial, local government itself, looking at compliance, their particular supplier databases, and how they view their own procurement. Going to procurement itself, contract unbundling, looking at setting quotas for youth and women, having supply chain management processes that look at monitoring and that, looking at demand versus supply initiatives, having a supplier database that is comprehensive, where BEE is reported initially, or quite comprehensively. That I like was the alignment between the triple PFA now and the BEE codes of good practice. So you can see that they were working towards that. A compliance of signature of invoice purchases agreement with financiers. So that is the one fundamental thing that I mentioned earlier on, that the PFMA and the MFMA do not allow for SME to cede or to use invoices as some sort of surety. Can we try and adjust that in some way or form? And looking at simple things like early payment tools as a tool of execution. But the second approach would be external. So having people that would assist, bring in the financiers and the venture capital funds that can assist the small, medium enterprises that sit within a certain spectrum of turnover and revenue. Exposing people to equity investments and exposing them to bridge and working capital funding. Developmental. I think this is very important. Is developmental. So we've given them the finance, so let's try and develop them going forward. As having integrated supply development and using special purpose vehicles for them to grow, and the promotion of co-ops, especially tourism. The wine industry is doing that right now, but the promotion of co-ops is quite important. But from a management perspective, is looking at quarterly supplier summits. One of our initiatives, and I think this is how we got to this, was we were looking at the Tshwane Metropole in itself as saying, let's start a supplier summit that will create platforms. It will create a platform for suppliers, whether they be youth, whether they be women, to come in and be introduced to manufacturers, cutting out the middleman, cutting out the agents, hence inflating the margins of how SME quote, bringing in financiers, bringing in people that can assist them with working capital and bridge funding, but also bringing in people that can assist them with predominant skills development and skills exchange. So having a robust system that will assist small enterprises, but looking at it not particularly in a silo, saying there are people that are doing this already, why can we not do it all together? So the supply of this would be obviously the same. Macroeconomic frameworks, we're looking at the environmental level, legal and regulatory framework. Financial sector level, we're looking at market infrastructure, commercial banks, bridge financing institutions, and other financial institutions, equity lenders, and people that are looking or in their own personal capacity, I guess, as well as the firm level, bringing in business associations. We have the IDC looking at a fast-track program, predominantly focusing on this issue that there are SME out there that want to do it, they get the tender, but they lack that particular bridge and working capital for them to kickstart their own initiative. So if organizations like the IDC and Kula and all of those are looking at this, clearly they know that this is a huge problem in assisting SME. Networks and clusters, harnessing that, I think the one important thing is creating a level of social capital within SMEs, is saying create your own social capital outside of the economic and human capital that is out there. Network amongst each other and assist each other going forward. Creating a realm of social entrepreneurship. These are the things that we fundamentally believe in, and we fundamentally believe will assist SME to grow, as well as procurement platforms. I mean, if you've created all of this, what's the point if SMEs cannot have people that buy from them? So this is something that I think we really need to work on. A mutual guarantee fund, where we look at dynamic partnerships with reinforce the bank's interests. So sharing risk with the bank. So government saying we might be able to share risk with the bank, allowing for invoices and for tenders to be surety or guarantees for things. Bridge financing. We're looking at assisting. We've already started speaking to a few companies. They're very limited that would want to assist. And we're not talking about the major banks here, but very limited institutions that want to assist SMEs with bridge financing. The IDC has come up with a fast track. There's a few other privately owned companies that have said they're willing to assist. So it is that particular issue of being able to seed or surety all of that, and allowing SMEs to have some form of comprehensive skills development and skills onset that will create, I guess, it's a form of comfortability within these institutions for them to lend the money. And importantly would be the business associations. So general business associations lack institutional capacities that are weakly represented in the SME market. Business associations generally look at the larger corporates. This is very important, is to say let's bring in these business associations to assist with the financing gap, dialogue with the state to improve the environment, organizations of mutual funds, collaboration with financial institutions to guide these services, training or certifying of SMEs to lower their own risk. Once they've lowered their risk, they can assist in lowering their own credit scoring, and I guess then they can go to the bigger banks to get what it is that they require. The network and clusters, these SME grassroots organizations can play a powerful role to reduce SME finance gaps at three levels of environment. Financial sector and non-financial support for SME. And the possible actions is projects supporting networks and clusters where the financing needs have been looked successfully tackled. And the last thing would be the supplier summit, to say each metropole needs to come with the supplier summit that, like I said, let's not work in silos, bringing in all of those individual key players that can assist them to create this and create it as an imperative, because it really is. So indirect access to manufacturers has always been an issue, where we've done some research, especially in the Tshwane metropole, where a lot of SMEs could not buy General Electric equipment because manufacturers would not sell directly to SME because they were afraid that they wouldn't pay on time, what. So they would have an agent, who'd have another agent. So by the time that the SME would actually bill the local municipality and they would have to pay that agent, they'd literally make a minimal margin or return on investment. So we're trying to cut out all of those issues to assist the SME going forward. And I think another thing is that there is a lack of direct involvement by large corporates. And let me not say that there is no involvement. Most large corporates assist because they need to meet the enterprise development targets. We understand that. Well, we have multinationals that come into this country, and because they want to meet the equity equivalent targets, they assist. Microsoft did it, where they did the equity equivalent, where it was an IT-specific enterprise development. Can we try and move away from meeting enterprise development targets? Over and above that, I believe that, or we definitely believe that large corporate needs to get involved with the assistance of SME, even if it's on a big brother basis, to assist them regardless of trying to meet their own specific quotas. What services do we think we can provide? Obviously, looking at industry spend, looking at the CapEx, our maintenance, repairs, and OPEX of things, operational expenditure.
You're only left with 2 seconds.
Okay, maybe 10, thank you. But mainly it's the structuring of the financiers and the structuring of the manufacturers. That is very important. Industry-specific analysis, the strengths and weaknesses of the suppliers, some clusters, but also the priority areas of competitiveness and improvement, sustainability of increased purchases from the manufacturers by the SMEs. Looking at the tiers of SMEs, level 1, 2, and 3 interventions, but mainly the skills development and assisting them to access the financing from different areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll call you by your direct name because you are very young. I would be worried. I'm not supposed to be doing that. Okay. Thank you very much. Together with Thabang Morupa, for your presentation, members, you did. This is the presentation. Actually, can we interact with it, Mr. Mare?
Thank you, Chair. Just a very brief. I mean, the services that you offer. Again, I think what we have said in terms of previous submission, absolutely valuable. That is where the often you see a business fail because of knowledge and expertise. If you don't transfer that, then there's no real empowerment. What is of concern to me is that not only yourself but the others this morning has all spoken about the lack of funding or the lack of access to funding for SMMEs. Have you spoken to National Empowerment Fund, which is 100%, in my opinion, in understanding for what you are doing and for your target market? And the other development finance institutions within the government sphere, surely that is what they are there for, to fund small business and entrepreneurs. And surely it is not only the government's benefit, but they need to increase the knowledge and skills of entrepreneurs. So have you approached them?
If not, why not? If yes, I mean, you haven't spoken about that, because that is to a large extent where I think the revenue fund is making funds available to support those sectors specifically on a yearly basis via the budget.
Okay. Let me answer first and I'll...
No. I'm the chair.
Okay.
Just wait, I'll give you the opportunity. The next person. Member Tessa. Note the question. Yes, we'll get an opportunity to respond.
Thanks, Chairperson. The slide and the suggestion, slide 15, the proposal here of under management for quarterly supply assignments to discuss impact of projects. I also know what would be the financial implication of this summit if they are held quarterly and for a small business.
The proposed implementation overview under that, okay. All right. Any other? Are we fine? Okay. You may respond.
Thank you, Honorable Member Murray. What we have looked at as challenges facing small businesses, a lot of them are doing their business in far removed areas. I just want to give a case in point which we did, or I did a test on it. You find that the IDC out of Golden 10 advertises what you have as a fast track product to assist SMEs. But someone sitting in a remote area in the Eastern Cape who has received a contract or who is running a B&B, for example, who can't get to Centen or wherever the IDC is, doesn't have access to the IDC. What we then say is we need to look at a way where Kula and IDC and them can get closer to the SMEs, closer to where they operate. Even if it's saying having implementation units within the municipalities or within the areas in which the co-ops operate, but taking the capital closer to the SMEs. What we see in a trend that's developing is that you then get those that have access to those developed markets or developed areas going to borrow the money and still coming and giving the burden on the SMEs that can't access it. So to get your coolers and IDCs being closer to where the SMEs are operating is of critical importance. And hence we say that the intent from government and government organizations is there, and we can all see it, but whether it's getting down to the people timelessly to enable them to make their business a success is quite questionable. In terms of subsidies, I'd like to ask Komoso to respond on that. Quarterly supplier summit.
Thank you, Honourable Member Potezi. The quarterly supplier summit to discuss impact of projects was, like I mentioned earlier on, our focus was looking at it from a metropole perspective. And the quarterly summit, maybe I should have elaborated further, was that the initial one we were looking at General Electric, we were looking at electrical manufacturers and manufacturer suppliers to get them closer with the SMEs. The next one would probably look at civil or general building. The next one would look at probably civil suppliers. They would each have a different theme in terms of procurement platforms and focusing predominantly on that particular cluster or that particular sector. So I should have elaborated a little bit more on that.
Thank you. You look like you're doubting whether to pose the question or not.
Yes, Chairperson. There's one slide where you were talking about some of the obstacles largely relating to financial institutions demanding collaterals and so on. You know, Chairperson, I once was in a meeting in my constituency where one of the issues was about exactly this, assisting small businesses to to emerge and begin to work and be sustainable. One of the most touching experiences relating to this, one young woman came up to say, you know, I was asked if I had a marriage certificate. So that I could qualify for funding from an institution that is supposed was actually established for this particular purpose. So you're talking about here an exclusion simply because you are unmarried. And I found this rather perturbing, because it means the young people who are unemployed, who would want to establish businesses, besides the collaterals of you know, big things like your house, you get asked whether you have a life insurance policy, yet you are unemployed. These are some of the obstacles that I thought that I should bring up, and I don't know whether they would want to comment about that. Perhaps they would have experienced that as well.
Thanks, Mr. Kovelza. I don't see any hand, meaning that they've exhausted, but I do have questions. I actually have a comment around the statement, ma'am, that says it shows from 1995 to date that we haven't made much progress. I think I agree, but that is why there is the establishment, the president saw it fit to establish departments like economic development and also rural land and rural development to deal with those kinds of special development issues, and also because the focus here is on poverty reduction and also job creation, so that we can be able to realize sustainable development at the end of the day. It is important that we think of that also when we have this. It's not that there's no development, it's just that it's not reported. Hence, I think we haven't had, in most of the presenters, mentioning, you know, the role that, whether they have engaged or interacted with Summer, for instance, with Kula, for instance. We all hear ICC. That's the extent at which people are eager. The ICC is supposed to deal with industrial development. I think that's where the problem might be, that while we have categorized this financial institutions or financial development institutions, we haven't really made people to understand the roles that they're supposed to be playing, which is one of the responsibilities of this committee, to ensure that those parastatals ensure that they send correct messages. I think it's very, very important that when we talk SMME development, Kula and them are there. I think already you have seen in Kula, in the paper advertisements, where Kula have begun to sort of showcase, you know, the work that they are doing. In everyday paper, I guess, you will see an example of what Kula is doing. This is through efforts of committees like this, so that you begin to understand what these people are, and you know the people that have benefited from such institutions. I think that is one of the areas that you've mentioned, that there's a lack of communication, I think, by these institutions. I think also NAASA, yes. NASA, they have also came with that issue, of which I think is something that I think we need to emphasize on. But then what's the role of institutions or of companies like yourself, for instance, in ensuring that you augment, you know, the work that they're doing, because we are dealing with these people. Make sure that we inform them, because we are also informed. We are better informed because we interact with this with these institutions on a daily. What's your role in ensuring that you sort of help in communicating, you know, the work that they're doing, so that the people that you are supposed to be assisting have knowledge and are able at the end of the day to access those institutions?
Noted, Chairperson.
Just a minute. I know young people are quite hyperactive sometimes, and they would want to jump in from time to time. I do understand you. I have one at home, too. The commercial bank's role, it didn't come up, or it's not only the question. I'm going to be disappointed. I don't know whether I'm being unfair to you, but I just heard from all other sources so that you know, the role that the bank is supposed to be playing, that that is quite difficult and so forth and so forth, especially around, you know, the requirements needed for them to be able to finance you. And you're saying the government should play that role of, you know, giving providing collateral or guarantees. I don't know, but I think if you research very well, you'll understand why government has done that. It's not allowed, you know, themselves to be also doing this, but they could do that through other means, for instance, other means through other departments other than finance, because, it's, you know, to provide a collateral to one company on one particular contract, for instance. Can you imagine how many businesses are there? And if you allow that to happen, I think this session, we should also use it as also the information session. Can we imagine what impact will that have on the coffers of government? Because if one company fails, for instance, to do what it's supposed to be doing, then the government is liable. You know, it has consequences. So it's important that when we look at it also, we look at even much more broader. Perhaps you'd want to develop it even further, or maybe I'm just reading this incorrectly. It's important that I also have a correct understanding of what you're saying. Otherwise, yes, let me give you the opportunity to respond before I give closing remarks. Thanks.
Chairperson, to answer your question on what are we doing as young people, it's exactly what my colleague has intimated, that this started off by saying, let's create awareness and let's create a summit and take it to the people and showcase to the people what suppliers are there and what funding and is available out there. And also to then say to your CEDAs, your coolers and your summers to say, you need to be operating closer to the guys who are getting the small and medium opportunities. In terms of government avoiding the exposure of issuing security and sessions, one also needs to raise the responsibility. You find in banking that, you know, banks say they don't want to be reckless lenders. Sometimes we also need to look at ourselves and say, municipalities as well need to not be reckless issuers of contracts that people don't have the capacity to execute. If I'm a small enterprise that can only manage R1 million, and government gives me a contract to do something for R100 million, have they done their work to trust me with that responsibility? And if they issue me a contract for R100 million, can they then walk the path with me to shoulder that? Can they shoulder that responsibility with me? So there needs to be also on the part of the issuer of those contracts or tenders to vet or assess the capacity and the responsibility of the said small entrepreneur or small business. And I think that would go a long way to then avoid situations where people would default, because from the start, you have some comfort that that organization can handle an opportunity of that size. And hence, we also touched on saying we need to start encouraging the formation of youth and women cooperatives in our communities. We need to instill a culture of working together, because there is a high prevalence now of competition amongst small enterprises. And we're saying if they can group themselves together and use to use that getting together in terms of that would ease their way of getting funding, and that would ease and make it easier for government to have comfort in the way they've structured themselves. And that issue of cooperatives needs to be looked at very strongly from a very low level of municipality level all the way up. Thank you.
Looking at Honourable Chairperson, the initial comment that was made, and I think I said, let me not shoot myself in the foot about the 15 years and nothing being done. We understand that a lot has been done, and a lot has been done that might not be out there for the world to see, but obviously we've seen the transformation going forward. The issue, I think, that I was trying to make quite prevalent was that we are talking about the same issue. We're not saying nothing's been done, but the same issue is being brought up again and again, that SME, we know what they're going to do for this economy. We know that the biggest issue of job creation is out there, and this is what we need for us to sustain this economy. Answering the issue of commercial banks, and you are right, having them literally give collateral for 50 million tenders every day is not going to get them, and the administrative sort of duties will be cumbersome. But what we're trying to say is, can we not let the issue of sessions or allowing an SME to take that invoice with the assistance that my colleague mentioned of the particular municipality or local government or provincial government holding their hand through it, for them to use that to go to the commercial bank? I will give you a particular example that banks, when they look at scoring particular organizations, is one of the issues that they look at is obviously your credit rating, your ITC, that and, but also where you bank currently. And there's a particular bank that people that are sitting at grassroots level would particularly use, and I'm not sure if I can mention banks by name. But if you are using that particular bank, regardless of how much money you have in that bank, the large four will not consider you for rating, or they will lower your score. And that in itself is segregating people that are sitting at grassroots levels that are trying to enter into the mainstream economy. So I hope that we've answered any other issues that were there. Thank you.
Okay. I wanted you to come in to say, because there are mechanisms in place, the systems in place to try and bridge by government through other institutions. That's why I wanted you to come in. Is this not enough? And I wanted you to show me the loopholes. I know there's a gap issue that you've alluded to here in terms of your proposal, but I needed to understand you further on that. But it's fine. Let's leave it in at that, and then we can engage outside the formal meeting. We really appreciate your presentation, and it encourages to see young people like yourself, standing up for themselves and doing something to help even
others who cannot help themselves. It's quite encouraging, and your submission is really noted by the committee. Thank you very much. Let me also use the, in closing, because the members must go and have lunch before they go to the chamber. Let me take this opportunity really to thank you very much. Your submission and your presentation are not going to go in vain. We are really going to look at them. We have received a lot of submissions, about 40, and but with a few of the companies interested in making a verbal presentation, like you're doing. But thank you very much for availing yourselves and making us understand your work even more clearer. We will then process them as the committee and hope that some of your views, proposals, will be taken through. What I mean is will be processed into something more tangible. We are hoping as a committee, because we are not the final people in making this policy at the moment. Thank you very much. And the meeting stands adjourned. May I request members to remain, please, for a few minutes.